Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week we'll begin our look back at 2024 with fiction and award-winning books. We began the year with Jamie Attenberg, who had a great year with two books, making it onto the New York Times bestseller list, 1,000 Words of Summer, a terrific writing guide, and her most recent novel, A Reason to See You Again, was published later that year. This was her 10th book, and her advice to writing nerds, reading nerds, and book nerds was dive in. Kayla Min Andrews was part of one of the loveliest stories of the year. After her mother, Catherine Min, died in 2019, Kayla's uncle established a residency at the McDowell Writers Colony. After an enthusiastic reading there, Kayla set about editing her mother's manuscript and writing it afterward.
She was a fiction writer her entire life. She wrote short stories. She had her debut novel, Secondhand World, and then she was working on The Fetishist for years. But then as soon as she got her cancer diagnosis, she says it happened literally in the oncologist's office. She decided, you know, I don't want to write fiction anymore. Like, I want to explore nonfiction, which she had never written before. But she just realized in that moment, like, my time is limited. And in my very limited time, I don't want to finish polishing. You know, she was in the polishing stage for The Fetishist. She had a solid manuscript. But, you know, she was always a perfectionist. And so she wasn't ready to put it forth yet, but she was really close. But then as soon as she knew her time was limited, she was like, I want to write personal essays. I want to explore what I've lived through and who I am and make sense of mortality and my dying process. And so she switched to essays.
So much of this novel, like your mother's first, Secondhand World, which is such a beautiful book, is about mothers and daughters. So it must have been like having a conversation with her as you went through that manuscript.
It is interesting. Yeah, The Fetishist is about a grieving daughter in particular.
Right.
And her quest for meaning and healing and revenge and violence after her mother's death. So that is an interesting parallel that I definitely recognized some of myself in Kyoko's daughterly devotion, you know, this kind of fierce, pure devotion towards her mother. But I also feel like I wish I was as cool as Kyoko. Like, it's more aspirational.
Now, you write in the afterword about long, wonderful afternoons with her reading, which I loved so much, and how she encouraged you in her own way to become a writer or to become more engaged with the world. So tell us a little bit about that path and how she influenced you.
So growing up, we read novels out loud together. I mean, starting when I was a kid, but then continuing in my teenage years. And then, you know, after I left home for college, when I would come back for vacations and stuff, reading out loud and kind of experiencing literature together and then talking about it was a big part of what we did with our time together. And also she would read me her works in progress out loud, like her first novel, Secondhand World. I remember she would read chapters to me as she was writing them. Yeah, it was never like, you should become a writer like me.
Yeah, right.
But I think it was more like she could tell that this was something that I was passionate about and I loved, and we loved talking about stories. And I wrote as a kid. But yeah, her message to me was always, I think that I'm more cautious by nature. She was a big, like, risk taker and very bold and kind of larger than life, out there making things happen, decisive. And I was always a little more cautious. And her message to me was always kind of like, you know, if you trusted the world a little more, shared a little more of yourself with the world, I think the world would appreciate it and it would be good for you. And as she was dying, I realized, I don't know, it kind of hit me the extent that I wasn't doing that, or the extent that I wasn't really happy or proud of how I'd been living. kind of seeing her die, and there was a source of solace in knowing that she had lived the way she had wanted to live. And it just kind of came naturally to me at that time. I was like, oh, I'm not living how I want to live. So how could I fix that? I was like, oh yeah, get back to writing. Because I didn't write for the first 10 years after college. So yeah, in my early 30s, I was like, I'm gonna start writing again. And it felt so right in terms of mom, you know, she had said it before, but she also said it in hospice, like, I wish you would share more of yourself with the world, something like that. And so it feels very connected to that now that I'm writing, and it feels really right for what I want to be doing and what I've kind of always been yearning to do, but didn't quite dare before.
The American Daughters by Maurice Carlos Ruffin is a terrific story of resistance to the Confederacy by Black women in New Orleans. Well, the beginning of this book has one of those stories that I just love, because it was one of those happy accidents that happens when you're rooting around in a New Orleans archive and find something that just leads you in a great direction. So tell us about the origin story of the American Daughters.
Well, it started in an archive at the Historic New Orleans Collection around 2004. And I was doing some research, and I stumbled upon some articles that talked about how the Confederates of that time didn't really mount a full defense. And I had wondered about that for a long time. Then I came on research later about my ancestors and about other ladies in the city around that time. And I just started wondering, what if the ladies from my family were actually the reason why the Confederates couldn't fight so hard? They were sabotaging them from the background the entire time. And I made this book.
Genius. Now, listening to ancestors is an important theme of this book too, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
So talk a little bit about the importance of that in your life and as life as a writer.
Well, I think for all of us, our ancestors are very important to us. I think for many African Americans, one of the challenges is that once you go past, say, 1870 or so, the records are not very clear, because many of the Black folks from that time, you have their first name and that's it. Mm-hmm. Of course, in New Orleans, there were many free people of color also where you could get the information. And so I think for me, it was a combination of finding actual documents, doing some research on sites like 23andMe, for example.
Yeah.
But also this idea that comes from a scholar named Sadia Hartman, who talks about critical fabulation. And she says that sometimes you have to make these logical leaps based on what you know, because at that time, many forces were working to obscure these stories. And so we can work hard to sort of fill in the blanks and tell true stories.
So give us the setup. Give us the story of these three interesting women and how they fit together in this book.
Well, you know, this book, it kind of flew out. I think I wrote the first draft of this book in about 4 months.
Wow.
Which to me, I'm not that fast of a writer typically. But the story is pretty simple. So we have Audie, who is a sharp-witted girl, and Sunita is her fierce mother. They're inseparable. And they are enslaved in the French Quarter of New Orleans in the pre-Civil War times. Now, they're separated later on, but I think what this book is about is how, even in times where you feel like you are alone and that you have nobody backing you up, you can find and build community. And so, Audie comes across somebody named Lenore, who is a free woman of color. Like many people from that time, she owned her own business. Mm-hmm. So in the book, she owns something called the Mockingbird Inn, which is kind of wonderful little hotel where people hang out of all races and ages and genders. And I think what happens is that they each sort of give something to the other. Audie gains a sense of self and courage. And Lenore realizes that, you know, she can do more than what she's been doing in the past. And so it's like when peanut butter met chocolate, these two together create this really wonderful mixture of friendship and community building that I think people really enjoy in this book.
One of the things that's happening in writing today is that we're getting necessary correctives to those old tropes of the romance and the beauty of New Orleans. We're getting the way New Orleans really was, and as seen through maybe a different lens. You know, I think of those descriptions of the slave pens and Let Us Descend, which are just shocking. And I think of the subtle differences we see in this book of the between free people of color and the enslaved people. And these are nuanced and pointed examinations of what New Orleans was like. So I wonder if you talk a little bit about writing those passages.
Absolutely. You know, there have been so many writers and scholars working over the years to correct a lot of these narratives. I mean, people like Dr. Mona Lisa Saloy, Lane Kaplan Levinson, who I think has worked here in the past. Just this information that's out there. And I don't blame most contemporary people from not knowing what the history is, because it's just been buried. So even the example that I remember hearing maybe on Tripod one time, where they said there were 52 slave sites, but only two were marked, mm-hmm. and only one was correctly marked. So imagine if those sites were actually marked everywhere. We kind of go, oh, this house or this jail or this, you know, whatever was a slave site. And people say maybe it wasn't that bad. They've seen Gone with the Wind. You know, they've seen Scarlett O'Hara and, you know, Butterfly McQueen and, Hattie McDaniel having a great time. But nobody wants to be enslaved. That's why people always fight against slavery. And so I think in my narrative, I'm trying to show the darkness. I'm trying to show the difficulty and make people understand that, you know, the idea of, like, you're being brought from some rural area in Louisiana on foot, barefoot, you know, right. with, like, a rope around your neck and around your hands. You're being dragged behind this cart for 100 miles, 500 miles even. And you get to New Orleans, then they're like, it's time to be sold. You don't know where you're going to go, where you're going to go next. You don't know who you're going to be living with. I think it's very important to be very clear about what those things would be like if it happened to you today. And these characters, because they're so articulate and they're so observant, they can express to the reader what they're feeling. And I think that's why it's so important for people to understand that there is just a force in the human soul that refused to be enslaved. And mm-hmm. these ladies are a part of that. And I think as they come together throughout the book, you see how that allows them to really get their hands around what it means to be a human and not just a slave.
If you're just joining us, we're taking a look back at the year in fiction, 2024. I'll Give You a Reason by Anel Lopez. It's a short story collection about the lives of immigrants who live in New Jersey, and it was the winner of the Louise Merriweather First Book Prize. Even though Lopez originally immigrated to New Jersey, she always felt drawn to New Orleans.
What is it about this place that makes us think we can be great writers here?
We can, right?
We
absolutely can. I think that for me, I noticed right away there is a fantastic literary community here in New Orleans.
Very supportive.
Very supportive, very warm. Different from what you would find in New York City and in places like New Jersey, which rely a lot on, you know, being so close to New York City and sort of having access to that literary scene. New Orleans felt just welcoming and everyone was mm-hmm. super friendly. I remember going to a reading series called Dogfish.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, it was in someone's house and that was so mind blowing to me. And the number of people that would show up and the open mic and the snacks and the drinks and just the sense of friendship and fellowship. Which is mind-blowing.
And generosity.
To
do the work of keeping something like that going.
Yeah, right. To welcome a crowd into your home and to put it together every month. And
it's a great place.
Yeah.
Anel Lopez acknowledges her debt to her early experiences in that place in these stories.
I love a book like this because I love interconnected short stories.
Awesome.
I love it when they give you a place. And this takes place in a New Jersey immigrant neighborhood called the Ironbound. Mm-hmm. So give us a sense of that place.
So the Ironbound, in order to get to it, you kind of have to cross like through the train station.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you're coming from downtown and other areas. So it feels slightly secluded from the rest of the city. And it has a history of always being very welcoming to immigrants. There were at some point immigrants from Italy, from Germany, from Poland, mm-hmm. who made that neighborhood their place.
Right.
And so you would find tons of restaurants that reflected the demographics of the people that were there. And then it would change over time. But the thing that remains true about the Ironbound is that there's always a wave of people coming in. It is always that immigrant place.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes it really special. So I went to high school in the Ironbound. In my high school, it was super diverse. And a lot of us were immigrants, which was a great experience for someone who's brand new in the country. Like, I remember arriving at Eastside for the first time and someone asking me, where are you from? And I remember very distinctively not even knowing how to answer the question. Like, obviously, I know where I'm from, but no one had ever asked me that before.
Yeah.
Because I had just been, you know, in the Dominican Republic all my life. Like, no one asked me where I was from. I'm from where everyone else is from. But arriving there and being asked that question and then asking that question to someone else And all these kids in my class, like, we were all from somewhere else. Like, some of them were from Mexico. Some of them were from Honduras. Some of them were from Puerto Rico. Some of them were from Argentina. Some of them were from Brazil. Some were from Portugal. Some of them were from Nigeria. It was like everyone that had a history of immigration, we were all in that high school.
Yeah.
And it was like a wild experience because, you know, I would have never really imagined meeting someone from Poland at 14.
James Lee Burke has reached some kind of record with more than 40 novels, most set in Louisiana. His most recent, Cleat, was a look inside the sidekick of Cajun detective Dave Robichaux, Cleat Purcell. You've recently received a great honor in New Iberia, and
oh, yeah.
There's now a statue of you on Main Street in the downtown area.
That says it's a bronze statue, and it's a big one. it cost $100,000.
Oh, Jim.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm really honored and proud, yeah.
And it's by a wonderful sculptress from Houston named Shirley Scarpetta. So what did you think when you saw it? Did you send her pictures, or did you... What does it feel like to rule over Main Street in New Iberia?
Well, I just hope when the robins come, you know, there are hundreds of thousands. They fly down from the north, mm-hmm. and they all land in New Iberia. I hope the robins take care of my statue.
Post a guard.
But yeah. It's in a beautiful spot. It's right there on the town square. The square used to be across from the old Frederick Hotel, which I've written about many times. It's not there anymore, the hotel. But it's a great place to be. That's the old Spanish Trail. It mm-hmm. went from Miami, the Spaniards, through the Gulf States and all the way to New Mexico and finally to Los Angeles. You know, that Highway 90
yeah.
goes that far. Yeah. So it's like sitting on or standing on the side of 400 years of American history.
So
that's
much,
it about man. Louisiana. Golly, just it's everywhere. You put your hand on the past, you can't avoid it.
Right.
It's just like there's a heart thumping inside a live oak.
The debut novel Habitations by Sheila Sunder, professor at University of Mississippi, is a story of a peripatetic academic looking for home. While in her first novel, Foreign Seed, Allison Alsop gave us a work of historical fiction about the plant hunter who brought us the Meyer lemon. If you're just joining us, we're taking a look back at the year in fiction, 2024. Walkin' Blues by Kalamu Yassalam is one of those novels that have been languishing in a drawer. Readers will be happy it finally came to light. It's his version of Robert Johnson at the crossroads. There's something you say in this book about Robert Johnson wanting to be, because the book is based on his life, wanting to be the kind of musician where people always remembered where they were when they first heard him.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds to me like Langston Hughes is that kind of touchstone for so many
yes.
people, don't you think?
Yes, Langston Hughes, I would later find out he spent a whole summer in New Orleans.
Wow.
And Langston Hughes was the person that gave me permission to be a writer,
mm-hmm.
be a world traveler, and really be interested in what was going on in the world. Langston Hughes, as I found out later on, was part of a group of people who were invited by the then newly formed government of the Soviet Union in the 20s to go to Russia to work on a update of Uncle Tom's Cabin.
Wow.
Of course, it never happened.
Mm-hmm.
By the time they got to Russia, it was a big mess. So the Soviet Union gave them ticks back to their points of origin, And Langston Hughes, being Langston Hughes, decided not to go back through Europe. He wanted to go back through Asia.
Ah.
And then across the Pacific and into the west coast of the United States, which is what he did.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the subconscious encouragements to me to travel.
Sure.
and see the world. So I ended up, I was in the army. I was on a mountaintop in South Korea. I stood on the Great Wall of China and all that kind of stuff, and traveled through the Caribbean and South America as a result of being influenced by Langston Hughes. At the time, I didn't realize it. Looking back on it now, sure. I see that this was one of the things that encouraged me to travel. And so I've traveled all around the world.
You know, the very first time I interviewed you, you said your philosophy was once a month out of the city, once a year out of the country.
Right.
My favorite work of fiction this year was Season of the Swamp by Yuri Herrera, a story of Benito Juarez's time in our city. Herrera really captures the rhythm of New Orleans.
The most pivotal thing to happen in the weeks that follow was the drumming. No. The most pivotal thing in the weeks that followed was the dances. No. The most pivotal thing in the weeks that followed was the concerts. No. In a way, it was kind of the hypodrome, which was fun and also pivotal, though in another way. No, the most pivotal thing to happen in the weeks that followed was the inner courtyard. Yes, that might be it. Or maybe the most pivotal thing to happen in the weeks that followed was that he met the canal and he learned what funk was. Or that he more or less figured out what Tisby might or might not have done. What happened in the weeks that followed was that they stopped feeling like weeks and instead sometimes felt like minutes, and in the minutes sometimes felt like days, because the city, first gradually, then vertiginously, stopped being a city of cons and wheeling and dealing and became a living creature, an animal that initially began to wriggle and writhe as if shaking off sleep or fleas, and then as if nothing in the world mattered more than dancing. Even the sailors had their own music. And not just inner music, not just the sing-song bitch and moan all down the street by the levee, sing-song bitch and moan about making no money. Money was one word he didn't know, a key word if ever there was, and about other things he didn't understand. At the front, a fiddler and a man with a military drum that he beat with military talent, bom, 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 rhythmic and energetic. While the fiddler played dance tunes, quick and peppy, that nobody danced to, since they were all walking, everyone but him, who accompanied the fiddle by nodding in time to the melody as if there were dancing couples doing little leaps and turns inside it. On and on they walked and saw the Theatre d'Orléans, which was staging a production of Meyer Burr's Robert le Diable, a very old opera, as well as Le Prophète. Le Prophète, which had been premiered in Paris only 4 years ago, so basically yesterday. What a place, forever renewing itself as though the swamp made no matter. The streets were perpetually under construction. Now that he and Pepe were staying at the boathouse in the Third Ward, he could walk to work, traversing the old quadrant to get to the print shop. He'd learned to sidestep the holes on one street and then find the next day that workers were patching it, only for it to begin crumbling again, then be patched again, over and over. The streets were under slapdash repair more often than they were traversable. Occasionally, the workers would rush around, portraits of exemplarity. More often, they'd sit on the sidewalk to smoke, drink, and sing. There was a lot of singing. Cabañas wouldn't let him touch the movable type. His job was to stack the ads, or notices, or pamphlets, or invitations, and deliver them. On rare occasion, he was tipped a coin for his trouble. But basically, he had to make do with what Cabañas paid him. In exchange, between trips through the quadrant, most deliveries went either there or to the Anglo Ward on the other side of canal. And reading the paper at the print shop, he started to see that, despite the cold, the city was hotting up. Carnival, Cabañas said. It's like everybody gets an itch that can only be scratched by going nuts.
And there was poetry by Nicole Cooley, Andy Young, Carolyn Embry, and many others. Former Times-Picayune writer Jonathan Eig won the Pulitzer Prize for his biography, King, A Life. The one book won New Orleans selection was Black Creole Chronicles, poems by Mona Lisa Saloy. The Ernest Gaines Award for Literary Excellence went to Aliyah Bilal, author of the short story collection, Temple Folk. Among the winners for the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities Awards this year, Freddie Williams Evans, Lifetime Achievement in the Humanities, Light Up for Literacy for Jane Wolfe of Eat and Read at Melba's. The Humanities Book of the Year was The Great Power of Small Nations, Indigenous Diplomacy in the Gulf South by Elizabeth Ellis. And Ben Depp won for Documentary Photography. His book is Tidelines, a photographic record of Louisiana's disappearing coast. Hope you'll join us next week when we look back at the year in nonfiction. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.